This is Monday, the 10th of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, Iraq's prime minister paid what many thought was a victory visit to the embattled city of Mosul Sunday, but today was somewhat of a different story.
Today there were lots of airstrikes. There were exchanges of gunfire, exchanges of grenade fire. We saw a car bomb, or the smoke from a car bomb.
That is VOA's Heather Murdoch in Mosul. We'll talk with her. Also ahead, we look at a ceasefire in Syria brokered by the United States, Russia, and Jordan, and we examine the latest news surrounding U.S. President Donald Trump, all on today's International Edition. On International Edition, we head to Iraq, where forces have slowly advanced Monday to retake the last patch of ground in Mosul, where Islamic State militants are holding on to a tiny sliver of the old city. And this takes place a day after the prime minister visited the soldiers to congratulate troops on the hard-fought battle. VOA's Heather Murdoch is in Mosul, and she joins us here on International Edition. Heather, what is the situation now? Is there still firing? Is there still fighting between the sides?
Yes, there's definitely still heavy fighting between the Islamic State militants and the Iraqi forces and the coalition forces. Today, there were lots of airstrikes. There were exchanges of gunfire, exchanges of grenade fire. We saw a car bomb, or the smoke from a car bomb. And the fighting is under such close quarters that a lot of it is also taking place house to house. The soldiers are entering houses occupied by Islamic State militants, and they say they're often hidden there wearing suicide vests. And also, it's also so close that when an airstrike hits in Islamic State areas, Iraqi-controlled areas, buildings in those areas shake. So it's a really tight area, but it's still really strong fighting. And we saw lots of Humvees coming out of the war, just ripping out of the war with the injured soldiers today. So it's still very real. And while it might end very soon, it might be confined.
Why do you think the prime minister visited yesterday to congratulate them, and that seemed to be a signal that all the fighting was over? Am I incorrect there?
No, you're absolutely correct. And this is the second time there's been a very public declaration of victory and celebration of victory. In fact, we saw soldiers dancing on streets today and shooting their guns in the air in celebration. Part, I think, it actually has to do with morale here. They declared victory, and the first time I asked lots of soldiers, like, doesn't it bother you that the prime minister has declared victory, yet you're still fighting, and people are still getting hurt and killed? And they said no, actually. They thought it was a vote of confidence from their government, because they believe that victory at this point is so much of a foregone conclusion that it's possible to declare victory. Also, the Iraqi military is very fragmented. They're very distinct different groups. And most of the groups that are fighting have completed their mission and taken every bit of the area they were supposed to take. It's only the special forces, one of the hardest frontline groups, that are still fighting in one of the hardest areas to capture.
Why is it so difficult to capture? Is it that they are totally entrenched? Are they using human shields? Why has this been so difficult, this last sliver of land?
There's a few reasons. I mean, first is the geography. The area is very, the buildings are very close to each other, so you can't bring a Humvee inside. You have to walk. Second is who's fighting. The people who are left, the Islamic State militants who are left, are believed to be mostly majority foreign, which often means the best trained Islamic State fighters that moved back the most times during this war and now are making their last stand in this tiny little place. There's an added thing, though, is that the generals here believe that there could be, or their families, are still in the buildings where the Islamic State militants are fighting. They believe these families to be the families of the fighters themselves for the most part, if not entirely. However, the policy is not to intentionally attack a house if there are civilians inside, and Islamic State families are considered civilians, especially children. So they're saying that they can't use heavy artillery at the moment, because as far as they know, there are still wives and children inside, so they can't demolish buildings in which Islamic State militants are fighting.
Any idea how many IS fighters are remaining there?
We've heard a lot of estimates, and the estimates range from between 50 and 150. Nobody is quite sure, although I did yesterday speak to somebody who was he surrendered or he was captured, depending on who you ask. But he's been accused of bombing state militants, and he was very definite that he said it was between 100 and 150.
What about the rest of the city? We've all seen the pictures that looks like total devastation for the entire city. Is anything happening there? Is it a ghost city? Are any families trying to come back? What's the story there?
Well, there's a large variety to what's happening inside Mosul. In the old city of Mosul, where most of the news is coming from now, because the battle has been centered here for a month, more than a month, and it's completely devastated. Nobody's trying to come back. The only people who are coming back are looking for the bodies of their loved ones in the rubble. And I don't think, I think there'll be a very long time before people ever consider living there again. But in other parts of Mosul, especially East Mosul, which was captured by Iraqi forces and coalition forces in January, everyone's coming back. People who are fleeing their homes now or have fled their homes in recent weeks are going to East Mosul to stay with friends and relatives there. There's, businesses are open. It's not, life's not back to normal by any means.
That is Heather Murdoch, VOA, live from Mosul, speaking to us on hopefully an acceptable telephone line. And believe me, it is the best we could do. Doug Bernard's here to talk about social media. What's going on today, Doug?
Well, the president's tweeting seems to be confusing some people. A few days ago, after the G20 summit, he sent out this tweet. Putin and I discussed forming an impenetrable cybersecurity unit, whatever that is, so that election hacking and many other negative things will be guarded. That sent out a response of politicians on Twitter. Senator Lindsey Graham calling it, he wrote out, not the dumbest idea I've ever heard, but it's pretty close.
Knew it, yeah.
Senator McCain, no fan. Representative Ted Lieu, who used to work in the computer industry, called the proposal, quote, dumb as a rock. Well, now, all of that just led to today, where the president is tweeting out, the fact that President Putin and I discussed a cybersecurity unit doesn't mean I think it can happen. It can't. But a ceasefire can and did. Now, that is leaving a lot of people confused with whether it's on or off or what's going on. In fact, the United States former ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, responded to the president, "What is going on with our president?" This tweet completely contradicts earlier tweet. So a lot of confusion out there about whether this is going to happen, what it may be. But just given it seems to be going over like a lead balloon, maybe it's going to die an early death.
Is my recollection bad, or is this the first time the president has stepped back on something that he has previously tweeted?
No, it's a very good question. He's stepped back on comments that he's made. We've seen this in news conferences and other events, but I can't recall a moment where he came out on Twitter proposing something and then pulled it back right away. So usually he kind of backs up his stuff. He doubles down, I guess the phrase would be, on social media.
Sometimes it would be interesting to be a fly on the wall of the Oval Office, would it not? That is VOA's Doug Bernard with us with social media. Among the top stories in the world, the Kremlin says it was unaware of a 2016 meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump's senior staff, including Trump's son, and a Russian attorney who promised to give him damaging information about Trump's challenger, Hillary Clinton. Iraqi forces continue to fight remaining Islamic State militants in Mosul, even as officials celebrate victory. A hospital treating Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo says he is too ill to travel overseas for treatment, saying the Nobel Prize laureate is in critical condition. The Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko says his country is beginning discussions on a membership action plan with NATO. According to a Syrian war monitor, a ceasefire covering three provinces in the southern part of that country is largely holding, with a few reports of violence. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study suggests that our Milky Way galaxy could be home to between 25 and 100 billion brown dwarfs. A brown dwarf is a celestial object with a mass somewhere between a star and a planet. A brown dwarf was supposed to become a star, but sometime during its formation was unable to gain enough mass that it could sustain the needed hydrogen fusion at its core to actually become a full-fledged star. The researchers focused their search within several dense star clusters, which are groups of stars that are gravitationally bound to each other. They found 5 brown dwarfs for every 10 stars in one of the clusters. To see if this was an unusual proportion, they checked another, more distant cluster and found the same ratio of brown dwarfs to stars. The researchers presented their findings at the recently concluded National Astronomy Meeting in the UK. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
We have an update on the story about Mosul in Iraq. Heather and I were talking, as you heard, about the prime minister coming to Mosul yesterday and basically declaring victory, although he didn't use those words, and the fighting went on. Well, now Iraq's prime minister has declared victory, said it in the words, against the Islamic State group in Mosul. More information as it becomes available. Meanwhile, the Syrian government and opposition are taking part in a 7th round of Geneva peace talks beginning today, as the U.S.-Russian-Jordan-brokered de-escalation agreement appeared to hold in the country's south. Yahya Aridi is a Syrian opposition spokesman.
We hope that something would come out of this, although the expectations are quite low. But we felt that there is an international serious endeavor and effort to bring peace and tranquility to Syria, especially in light of what happened in the south, in that de-escalation of hostility in the south, which is quite important because the main concern of our people is to live in peace. Russia has been waiting for an American strategy to crystallize towards vis-a-vis Syria, and we believe that this is quite seriousness on the part of the United States to broker such a ceasefire, and we want it to be extended to other parts of Syria.
The ceasefire was announced Friday in Hamburg during a G20 summit, but a U.S. State Department official said further discussions are still ahead on how to monitor the ceasefire. We continue on International Edition. President Donald Trump tweeted late Sunday that just because he and Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed forming a cybersecurity unit doesn't mean he, President Trump, thinks it can happen, adding that it can't, as we just discussed with Doug Bernard. In an earlier tweet, Mr. Trump said during a meeting on the sidelines of last week's G20 summit, the two leaders discussed forming an impenetrable cybersecurity unit to guard against future election hacking and other negative things. He also said it is time to work constructively with Russia. Mr. Putin has denied interfering in the U.S. election. Appearing on the Fox News Sunday program, the White House Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, insisted the president did not accept that denial.
The president absolutely did not believe the denial of President Putin. What the president did is he immediately came into the meeting, talked about Russian meddling in the U.S. election, went after that issue at least 2 separate times. This was not just a 5-minute piece of the conversation. This was an extensive portion of the meeting. And after going at it with President Putin more than once, 2 times, maybe even 3 times, the president at that point, after spending a large part of the meeting on the subject, moved on to other topics.
Priebus said while Mr. Trump believes Russia probably did meddle in the election, so did other countries. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, appearing on the NBC program Meet the Press, was puzzled by the proposed joint cybersecurity unit with Moscow.
It's not the dumbest idea I've ever heard, but it's pretty close. He gave a really good speech in Poland, President Trump did, and he had what I think is a disastrous meeting with President Putin. 2 hours and 15 minutes of meetings. Tillerson and Trump are ready to forgive and forget when it comes to cyber attacks on the American election of 2016.
Graham said Mr. Trump is hurting his ability to govern by forgiving and forgetting when it comes to Russia, referring to Mr. Putin as a nemesis of democracy. U.S. lawmakers are considering further sanctions against Russia for its meddling in the November election. Meanwhile, The Washington Post reports hackers who penetrated the business networks of U.S. energy and nuclear companies in recent weeks are working for the Russian government. It said operations of the affected companies were not disrupted. This is VOA.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Tell you a little bit more about another story we headlined just a few minutes ago. The Kremlin is now saying it was unaware of a 2016 meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump's senior staff and a Russian attorney who promised to give them damaging information about Democrat Hillary Clinton. A Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, says it does not know the lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya, and cannot keep track of every Russian lawyer and their contacts overseas. Trump's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., said Sunday that he, Trump's then-campaign manager, Paul Manafort, and President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, met with a Russian lawyer in June of 2016 after Trump had clinched the Republican presidential nomination. Veselnitskaya has said she would share information that could hurt Clinton's campaign. But Trump's son said that no details or supporting information was provided or even offered. It quickly became clear that she had no meaningful information, said Trump's son. Trump's son said his father was unaware of that meeting. China says that the U.S. has apologized after Beijing officially protested a White House statement incorrectly, calling Xi Jinping the president of the Republic of China. She is the president of the People's Republic of China, while the Republic of China is the official name of Taiwan, which Beijing considers a breakaway province awaiting reunification. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman said the U.S. side has expressed that they're sorry for the technical error and they have made a correction. The White House made the error in an official readout of a meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and Xi during the G20 summit in Hamburg last week. The strained U.S. relations with Turkey are beginning to improve, but will require much more work, according to Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Speaking Monday with the staff and families of the U.S. mission in Istanbul, Tillerson said, I think we are working very hard to rebuild that level of trust that is the basis for any relationship. Went on to say it's important for so many reasons, which is why we must put the relationship on the mend, reestablish it on the proper basis, and strengthen it going forward. He cited the war in Syria as one of the issues on which the two countries have made progress, but must continue to work together. This is VOA's International Edition. The third installment of the new Planet of the Apes films opens in U.S. theaters in a couple of weeks. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, war for the Planet of the Apes continues chimpanzee Caesar's evolution into a leader of his simian people.
You're Caesar. We've been searching for you for so long.
I do not start this war. I fight only to protect apes.
Motion capture actor Andy Serkis returns as Caesar, the chimp who has developed from a young ape into the leader in this third installment. Caesar fights to protect his family, and his attitudes toward humans continue to change in this film. Serkis, known also for his performance as Gollum in The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit movies, says his character is beginning to take on the role he seems destined to assume.
Of course, in this one, Caesar, he's older. He's also evolving from being ape-like into more human-like, certainly in terms of his facial expressions, his thinking, his emotions, beginning to feel more human-like, and linguistically he begins to feel more human-like.
The film uses the latest in motion capture technology, something that director Matt Reeves says makes the most of the actors' performances.
The actors are there. I think what happens is a lot of people think, oh, well, you go and, you know, the people who are playing the human characters, they must be playing to tennis balls or something. The actors are there. So we shot in the snow, we shot in the rain, we shot in the freezing cold. Well, Andy Serkis and Steve Zahn, all of the actors, they were there in their mocap suits. So it sounds, the complex part of it is once you shoot actors in their mocap suits, getting everything else you need in order to make those shots come to life.
Woody Harrelson joins the story as Colonel McCulloch, a human who is obsessed with destroying the apes and especially their leader, Caesar. Harrelson says his character is not a cartoon villain, but a man who wants to save his race and his planet.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely not just a simple kind of cutout. I think there's a lot to what goes on with him. Couple things that were, that he didn't use that I kind of liked, a couple scenes. But, you know, you watch the final product and it's great.
Andy Serkis says this film has more emotional depth and complexity than previous movies, and he thinks that audiences will love it.
I think this is really powerful, this movie, and it's a very emotional film. I mean, last night watching it, people were literally crying, you know. So it is. It's also got great humour in it. It's an epic. It's a mythic story. I think it's a brilliant blockbuster, which with heart and a lot of intelligence. So I think people will be moved by it and really care about the characters.
War for the Planet of the Apes is rated PG-13. It opens in U.S. theaters July 14th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin, our director, Dan Crafton, our engineer. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
An estimated 20 million people around the world are victims of the heinous crime of human trafficking. This year, the State Department's Trafficking in Persons report places particular focus on the responsibility of governments to hold offenders accountable. At the release of the 2017 report, U.S. Ambassador at Large to Monitor and Combat Human Trafficking, Susan Coppedge, noted how important the role of government is to the fight.
When governments enact and enforce strong, comprehensive anti-trafficking laws, they send an unmistakable message to criminals. We will not tolerate this. Traffickers, not their victims, should and will face punishment.
All governments must do more to combat trafficking, Ambassador Coppedge said, but a certain number are making little or no effort to do so. 23 have been listed as a Tier 3 country, in which the government fails to meet even minimum standards for the elimination of trafficking. The Islamic Republic of Iran is one of them. Iran, the State Department says, remains a source, transit, and destination for men, women, and children subjected to sex trafficking and forced labor, and the Iranian government made negligible efforts to address its extensive trafficking problem. No anti-trafficking law enforcement efforts were reported, and government officials themselves continued to be complicit in trafficking crimes, including the coerced recruitment and use of Afghan men for combat in Syria and the funding of militias in Iraq that recruited and used child soldiers. The report also pointed out the extreme difficulty for female victims of trafficking to obtain justice in Iran. Since the courts accord legal testimony by women, only half the weight is testimony by men, and female sex trafficking victims are liable to be prosecuted for adultery, a crime punishable by death. In his introduction to the report, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called human trafficking one of the most tragic human rights issues of our time, not only splintering families, but undermining the rule of law, encouraging other transnational criminal activity, and threatening public safety and national security. But worst of all, he said, the crime robs human beings of their freedom and their dignity. That is why every person and every government must pursue an end to the scourge of human trafficking.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.